Lecture 12, Structuring a Narrative Without a Plot.
Every work of fiction has a structure, but not every work of fiction has a plot. At least not a traditional plot like the ones I've been talking about in the last two lectures. But even if it doesn't have a plot, every work of fiction has to have something the writer John Gardner called profluence. Gardner defined profluence as the feeling that you're getting somewhere when you're reading a work of fiction. Let me suggest another way to think about it. Whether or not a story or a novel has a plot, something should change over the course of reading it, if not in the story itself, at least in the heart or mind of the reader. In this lecture, I want to suggest a few ways to structure fiction that don't involve using Freytag's pyramid or the traditional plot. I'll use some examples that don't raise the usual expectations, or that raise the reader's expectations and then confound them in a profound and subtle way. Let's start with short fiction. The short stories of the 19th century were generally plot-driven, even though many of them were not quite long enough to accommodate all the features of Freytag's pyramid. They usually set up a situation, invoked a conflict, and resolved it pretty quickly, often with a twist at the end. Think of all the stories you might have read in high school. Nathaniel Hawthorne's Young Goodman Brown, Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart, Herman Melville's Benito Cereno, Guy de Maupassant's The Necklace, O. Henry's The Gift of the Magi, and nearly all of Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories. Each one of these stories has a sting in its tail, as a secret is revealed or a twist is administered. Some of them, such as Young Goodman Brown and Benito Cereno, are quite profound, but compared to the modern short story, their effect is still pretty mechanical. This kind of story can be very satisfying, but it often doesn't quite feel like real life. The modern short story begins in the late 19th century with the Russian writer Anton Chekhov. He is perhaps better known as the author of such plays as The Cherry Orchard, Three Sisters, and Uncle Vanya. But among fiction writers, he is one of the most influential short story writers of all time. One of the most vivid reading experiences of my life, in fact, was reading his story The Kiss as a sophomore in college. It was a revelation to me at the time, because not only did it show me something profound about life, it showed me a whole new way of storytelling. What happens in The Kiss is very simple. The officers of an artillery regiment training in the Russian countryside are invited by a local landowner to spend the evening at his country house. During the course of the festivities, the main character, a very shy and buttoned-up officer named Ryabovich, wanders off by himself through the house. At one point, he walks into a completely darkened room. As he hesitates just inside the door, a woman rushes out of the dark, murmurs, "At last," and kisses him. An instant later, this woman realizes he isn't the man she was waiting for, and she flees the room, leaving the stunned Ryabovich in the dark. He steps into the lighted room where the party is going on and searches the faces of the women, but he never does discover who kissed him. Ryabovich and his regiment ride away the next morning. Up until now, his life has been utterly without passion, and for days afterwards, Ryabovich constantly fantasizes about this encounter. He even invents a whole future life, including marriage and children, with a woman whose name and face he doesn't even know. This is the most remarkable thing that has ever happened to him, and he spends the next few pages ringing like a bell that has been struck for the very first time. But at the end of the story, when his regiment returns to the same town, he loses his nerve as they pass the landowner's mansion. And when the landowner invites the officers back to his house that evening, Ryabovich stays behind in the barracks. And that's it. That's all that happens in the story. Scene by scene and sentence by sentence, it reads like a conventional story, full of vivid exposition, some sharply etched characters, and a fair amount of dry humor. The scenes are steadily laid out in chronological order with no flashbacks or flash forwards. And yet, the story does not come to a climax or resolve like a traditional story. Ryabovich does not develop as a character. He does not win or lose at the end. He's the same person all the way through the story. He has a brief glimpse of a more exciting life, but his only response is in his lonely imagination, and he does nothing about it. He was a gray little man at the beginning of the story. He's a gray little man at the end, and he will be, Chekhov implies, a gray little man for the rest of his life. And even though the story does not resolve in the traditional way, this realization about Ryabovich has a very powerful effect on the reader. If you really wanted to, I suppose you could plot the kiss on a Freytag pyramid. It opens with exposition, the description of Ryabovich and his regiment. It has an inciting action, the kiss in the dark. It has a rising action, Ryabovich brooding about the mystery woman for the next few weeks. And it even has a climax of a sort, when Ryabovich decides not to go back to the country house at the end. But the genius of the story is that it suggests a potential conflict and then refuses to resolve it, at least in the way the reader was expecting. Chekhov sets up a couple of binary questions. Who kissed Ryabovich, and will he ever find her again? And then, technically, Chekhov answers at least half of the question. No, Ryabovich won't find the girl. In fact, he won't even really look for her. That disappointment the reader feels at this turn of events is the point of the story. The real question is not whether Ryabovich gets the girl, but whether he can rise above his own timid nature. And that is a much more profound and unsettling question. To put it another way, Chekhov has performed a bait and switch on the unsuspecting reader. He starts with what looks like a sweet little love story and gives us instead a shattering and heartbreaking judgment of the main character. So even though nothing happens in the traditional sense, something profound does change over the course of the story, not in the character or in the situation, but in the reader. The first time I read The Kiss, at the age of 19 or 20, I approached the end of it with the expectation that it was going to resolve one way or the other. I expected that Ryabovich was going to be either happy or heartbroken at the end. But what I didn't see coming was that he's going to be just the same as he was in the beginning. I felt as if an abyss had opened at my feet as I realized that, yes, you can ruin your own life without even knowing that you're doing it. But I also felt exhilaration at the audacity and the tenderness of the story. Chekhov gives us an intimate and tragic portrait of a man who was presented with a vision of passion and does nothing about it. He does not find love, and he does not understand himself any better. And yet, even if nothing changed in Ryabovich, the story changed me profoundly. And that's what makes it a great story. I had a very similar feeling later that same semester, in the same class, when I read James Joyce's story, The Dead, for the first time. The Dead is the final story in Joyce's only volume of short fiction. Titled Dubliners, this volume of stories has been as influential for modern short story writers as Chekhov's short fiction, if not more so. Instead of a conventional climax or resolution, the stories in Dubliners rely upon what Joyce called an epiphany. This word comes from the ancient Greek word epiphaneia, which means an appearance or manifestation. In religious terms, the word epiphany means a deep spiritual insight or realization which has been brought about by divine intervention. Joyce used it to refer to an individual experiencing a moment of profound and sometimes life-changing self-understanding. The Dead is the longest story in Dubliners, about 60 pages long. And like The Kiss, it reads very conventionally, a steadily chronological account of a party in Dublin in the first week of January, 1904. It is full of evocative details, sharply observed characters, and gentle humor. Most of the story is told from the point of view of a middle-aged man named Gabriel Conroy. Gabriel is the sort of successful and reliable fellow who is relied upon to carve the goose at the party and deliver a slightly pompous after-dinner speech. Near the end of the party, Gabriel witnesses his wife, Greta, listening raptly to a singer performing an old Irish folk song. Then, in the cab to the hotel room that they've booked for the night, Gabriel is possessed of a powerful lust for his wife. His emotions have been stirred up by the happiness of the party and by the fact that they have a night to themselves without their children. But when they're alone in the room, Gabriel realizes that Greta is upset. She tells him that hearing the folk song at the party has reminded her of a boy named Michael Fury, who had loved her when she was a young woman. Fury used to sing that same song to her years ago, and he probably died because he stood in the rain waiting outside her window. Gabriel realizes that to make love to his wife at this moment would be akin to an assault, so after she falls asleep, he simply lies awake in the dark next to her. Gabriel's epiphany is his realization that Greta has never loved him as much as she loved the boy who died for her years ago. He further realizes that he has never loved her, or anyone else for that matter, the way that Michael Fury did. But instead of feeling rage or disappointment, Gabriel experiences a moment of expansive generosity for his wife, for himself, for Michael Fury, and enjoys his famous phrase, "for all the living and the dead." This is one of the most glorious moments in all literature. It knocked me flat when I first read it back in college, and it has knocked me flat every time I've read the story since, even though I know it's coming. Looking at the story as a whole, you might think that Joyce could have evoked Gabriel's epiphany in a shorter story, one that focused only on the aftermath of the party, but that simply wouldn't have worked. The first 40 pages of the story are a chronological and very entertaining account of the events at the party, and those scenes are structurally essential to what Joyce is trying to do. In those first 40 pages, Joyce shows us how a long married couple present themselves to their friends and acquaintances in a public setting, and he includes details about Gabriel that only pay off at the end. This makes their moment of unexpected intimacy at the end even more poignant and piercing. In other words, you need to see as vividly as possible, and at considerable length, the life that Gabriel thought he was living in order to understand his shock when he realizes that nothing he ever thought about his life was true. At first glance, the structure of the dead is similar to that of the kiss. Both are chronological. Both are centered around a party. Both are essentially a series of evocative scenes that do not really make up a conventional plot. The final effect of the dead, however, is different from that of the kiss, because Gabriel comes to a new understanding of himself, and Ryabovich does not. Think back to the distinction E.M. Forster made between a story and a plot, that the story tells us what happened, but a plot tells us why. Now think back to how a conventional plot does this, by posing a question in the form of a conflict, and then answering the question by resolving the conflict. The structural brilliance of the dead is that it does not set up a conflict at the start of the story. Instead, it holds your interest by giving you a plotless but entertaining and exquisitely detailed account of its main character and his social situation. Then it blindsides you at the end with a conflict that neither you nor the main character even knew existed. The conclusion of the dead is powerful partly because of what it says, that happiness is precarious and sometimes it's founded on a lie. But it's also powerful because of the way that Joyce plays with your expectations. If he had set up a conventional plot, opening the story with Gabriel wondering if Greta was happy in their marriage, for example, the ending simply wouldn't have worked. The power of the story comes from the way it gives us what looks like an ordinary situation for its main character, and then surprises both Gabriel and the reader with something extraordinary. Pardon my bad pun, but a conventional plot would have killed the dead. The use of everyday moments to build a picture of a world at a particular moment, in order to reveal something profound, also lies behind Virginia Woolf's great novel, Mrs. Dalloway. This book is set over a single day in London in the early 1920s, and it focuses on a well-to-do 52-year-old woman named Clarissa Dalloway as she prepares for a party at her home that evening. There are a couple other major characters as well. Peter Walsh, a former suitor of Clarissa's who has just returned from 5 years' service in India, and Septimus Warren Smith, a veteran of World War I who was suffering what used to be called shell shock and what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder. Other characters include Septimus Smith's Italian wife Rizia, Mrs. Dalloway's husband Richard, and her daughter Elizabeth, as well as a woman named Sally Seaton, with whom Mrs. Dalloway was in love when they were both young women. There are only a few conventionally dramatic moments in Mrs. Dalloway. These include the suicide of Septimus Smith and the meeting of Clarissa and Peter Walsh after many years. They also include Clarissa's flashback of the moment when Sally Seton kissed her, and Peter's flashback to the moment when Clarissa rejected his proposal of marriage, both of which happened 30 years before. Otherwise, most of the incidents in the book are pretty ordinary. Except for the death of Septimus, of course, it's a pretty unremarkable day. So given that there's no conflict as such, no climax, and nothing to resolve at the end, what gives the book its structure? What gives it profluence? What changes over the course of Mrs. Dalloway? Instead of using a plot to structure the novel, Wolfe uses two techniques. One of them governs the overall shape of the novel. The other governs its movement from scene to scene and from moment to moment within each scene. The overall shape is determined by the fact that the novel is set over the course of one day. This allows Wolfe to limit the number of incidents in the book and to limit the scope of the characters. There's only so much the characters can do and only so far they can go in a single day. And taking into account Clarissa and Peter's flashbacks to their youth, there's only so much of their past that they can remember in a day. One way to structure the formless chaos of an entire life in a narrative would be to select the most important or dramatic events and string them together in a plot, the way Hollywood biopics often do. Instead, Virginia Woolf picks one day and writes about the most important events, actions, meetings, and memories of that day. The intention is that these events are representative enough to give us a vivid impression of the character's whole life. The technique of setting a novel or story in a single day is fairly common. A few years earlier, James Joyce had used the same technique on a much larger scale in his novel Ulysses. Over the years, the technique has also been used by such writers as Eva Figgis in her short but very beautiful novel Light, which is about a day in the life of the family of the painter Claude Monet, by Malcolm Lowry in Under the Volcano, which is about a day in the life of an alcoholic Englishman living in Mexico, and by yours truly in my novel Next. And there are also more conventionally plotted novels that take place in one day. There are lots of thrillers in which the hero is working against the clock, and it's easy to imagine an historical novel about the day Lincoln was assassinated, for example. What's important to note about Mrs. Dalloway, however, is that it's not a particularly significant day in the life of any of the characters, except for Septimus, of course. Instead, the idea behind it is that by very closely observing the thoughts of a few characters over a limited period of time, you can evoke a particular period and a way of life, the way you might infer the ocean from a drop of water. In my first lecture about plot, I talked about the lesson I learned from my high school English teacher when she said that fiction imposes order on the chaos of reality. What we learn from the example of Mrs. Dalloway and other novels that take place in one day is that the order you impose doesn't necessarily need to be a conventional plot. You don't have to arrange the story's events in the usual way to have them mean something. The order you impose on reality can be as simple as focusing on the important details of a particular time period. The illumination of character or the evocation of a particular way of life in this way can be as satisfying as an old-fashioned plot. But even if you limit the events of your narrative to a single day, how do you make the narrative move forward if there's no conflict to be resolved? This brings us to the second method that Virginia Woolf uses in Mrs. Dalloway, the one that makes the novel flow from scene to scene and moment to moment. This is accomplished by Woolf's use of the stream of consciousness technique. In one of my lectures about character, I quoted a scene from the book that let us hear what Clarissa Dalloway was thinking as she looked in a shop window. As you may recall, the passage shifted very quickly from the sights and sounds of the world around Clarissa to memories of her girlhood, to the last days of her uncle, to her relationship with her daughter. Each brief moment in that passage tells us something about Clarissa Dalloway and her world that we didn't know before. What sort of girl she was, what sort of person her uncle was, what sort of relationship she has with her daughter. Using Gardner's term, this passage is profluent. even without Clarissa having to confront or resolve a conflict. The book devotes this kind of attention not just to Clarissa, but also to Peter Walsh, to her husband Richard, to Septimus Smith, and to Smith's wife Rizzia. Not all of these scenes are written in the same dense style Wolfe uses to evoke Clarissa Dalloway's consciousness. A long central passage from the point of view of Peter Walsh is written in a more conventional expository style, while the passages from the point of view of Septimus Smith are feverish and full of violent imagery that evokes his spiritual agony. In fact, perhaps the most remarkable and influential feature of Mrs. Dalloway is the way Wolfe effortlessly shifts the narrative's point of view from one character to another. These narrative shifts are what provide the momentum that other, more conventional books rely on plot to provide. There are long passages of Mrs. Dalloway where the point of view is limited to one character or bounces back and forth between two characters. But there are also several bravura sequences where the point of view shifts from one character to someone he or she has just passed in the street, and then on to another person, and so on. For example, only a few pages into the book, Clarissa hears an automobile backfire in the street while she's in a shop. And at that moment, the point of view quickly shifts from Clarissa to Septimus, who sees the same car. Then it shifts to Rizzia, then back to Clarissa, then to a woman selling flowers on the street, then to a couple of women and an old man outside the gates of Buckingham Palace, then back to Septimus and Rizzia, then to a girl named Maisie Johnson who asks Rizzia for directions, then to an old woman feeding the pigeons, and finally to a man standing on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral. Over the course of 15 pages, some of these characters get a couple of pages each, while others are inhabited by Wolfe for only a few sentences. It's a breathtaking piece of prose that requires more concentration from the reader than just following a plot. But if you stick with it, you end up with a more vivid evocation of a particular moment in the lives of these particular characters than you would have gotten from a more conventional narrative. So far, we've seen several different ways to structure a piece of fiction that don't rely on a plot. In Chekhov's The Kiss and Joyce's The Dead, the narrative uses a single moment to illuminate the rest of a character's life. While in Mrs. Dalloway, a chronology limited to a single ordinary day and a close attention to each character's most intimate thoughts evoke each character's entire life and a particular moment in history. Obviously, this sort of technique is not for everybody, and maybe not even for most writers. For all the difficulties we writers have with plot, and particularly with making a plot seem lifelike and not really like a plot, most of us fall back on it because, frankly, it's easier to do, and it's what most readers expect. An epiphany narrative like The Dead, or a plotless evocation of a single day like Mrs. Dalloway, require more effort and concentration from a reader than, say, the relentless, addictive, one damn thing after another forward momentum of a popular novel like Game of Thrones. Lots of readers don't see the point to a story like The Kiss. Or they tried to read Ulysses or Mrs. Dalloway only because guys like me tell them they ought to, and then they give up after 25 pages. There's nothing wrong with that. I know lots of intelligent, sophisticated readers who have no patience for Mrs. Dalloway. But I will say this. If you're willing to make the extra effort, Mrs. Dalloway reaches places in a reader that a conventionally plotted novel, even a great one, simply cannot. And more to the point, trying to write a story or a book with an unconventional technique can make you a better writer. It can make you more observant, more subtle, and more engaged, even if all you plan to do is apply what you've learned to a more conventional narrative. 4 of the 5 books I've written so far are conventionally plotted. But my 5th book, Next, was my attempt to apply the technique of Mrs. Dalloway to a different sort of life, only with more jokes. I'd like to think it's my best book. But even if it isn't, it made me dig deeper as a writer than I ever have before. As a matter of fact, the type of fiction I've been talking about in this lecture isn't even considered all that radical anymore. You'll notice that the 3 examples I've cited so far, The Kiss, The Dead, and Mrs. Dalloway, all date from the late 19th or early 20th century. And since then, another, even more adventurous literary technique has grown up, known as postmodernism. This is a huge topic which takes us beyond the scope of these lectures, and indeed beyond my own area of expertise. So without getting into the whole history of prose fiction since World War II, suffice it to say that a postmodern novel is one that plays games with language and with the usual narrative conventions of plot and character, and which consistently calls the reader's attention to the fact that he or she is reading a work of fiction. One of the hallmarks of postmodern writers is that they love jokes and puns, and they often like to play with structure. For example, David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest includes 388 footnotes that appear at the end of the book. Roger Boylan's novel, Kill Oil, includes footnotes on the same page as the text. These notes are often addressed directly to the reader and provide a sort of cranky and very funny commentary on the rest of the book. Even if you have no interest in creating this kind of fiction yourself, these books and stories are worth looking at because, over the past 40 or 50 years, many of the techniques of postmodernism have made their way into the mainstream. Take, for example, Jennifer Egan's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad. This is a novel and stories about a group of people who revolve around a rock and roll producer named Benny Salazar. Written in very accessible literary prose, the individual stories and the novel as a whole are humane and moving in a conventionally satisfactory way. But at the same time, Egan very cleverly uses a lot of techniques from the postmodernist toolbox. She arranges the stories out of chronological order. She tells one story in the second person, and most famously, she tells one of the stories in the form of a PowerPoint presentation. It's the best of both worlds, incorporating postmodern techniques in a very entertaining way, but delivering all the emotional satisfaction of a mainstream novel. An even more adventurous combination of experimental literary technique and old-fashioned storytelling is the British writer Kate Atkinson's Life After Life. In this remarkable novel, the main character, Ursula Todd, lives her life over and over again, with each parallel life playing out differently than all the others. Ursula dies at the end of each chapter, and then her life begins again in the next chapter with her birth in England in 1910. Several of the early chapters are very short, as Ursula dies in childbirth, or as an infant, or as a young girl. She goes on to die several times during the influenza epidemic of 1918. She is also killed by an abusive husband, and in one chapter, she dies during the Blitz in World War II. As the novel goes on, however, each of her lives is longer and more satisfying, almost as if Ursula is learning from each iteration of her existence. Like A Visit from the Goon Squad, Life After Life is written in an accessible literary style. The characters that recur throughout the novel, Ursula's parents, siblings, friends, and lovers, remain more or less the same in each life, even as Ursula's relationship with them changes from version to version. But the overall structure not only suggests that each of our lives is a series of accidents or coincidences over which we have little control, it also raises interesting questions about the nature of literary character, namely, how many changes can Atkinson make in Ursula and still have her be the same person? More importantly, the novel tests the very foundations of storytelling, which is what makes it postmodern. In most narratives, when the writer makes a choice about a moment in the plot, she closes off all the other possible plot lines. But in Life After Life, Atkinson deliberately works against that idea of closure. She can't show us all of Ursula's possible lives. That would take an infinitely long book. But she can suggest infinity by showing us a wide variety of them. Like A Visit from the Goon Squad, it's a remarkable and very satisfying combination of vivid storytelling and postmodern playfulness. If you think you might like to try some of the techniques I've talked about in this lecture, here's an exercise. Take a single character and write about an hour in that person's life, limiting yourself to 5 pages. Do not pick the hour when something significant happened to the character, when he killed somebody or fell in love, for example. Instead, pick one of the countless hours in a person's life where nothing particularly important is going on. But do try to put in as much detail about that person as you can, including memories or flashbacks, which might be provoked by something as simple as a smell or an overheard comment. By limiting the time period and the number of pages, you provide yourself with a structure that doesn't rely on plot. But if you put a lot of detail in, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at how much you can get across about the character. You may even get more than 5 pages out of it. Whether you want to tell a good old-fashioned story with a beginning, middle, and an end, or a crazy, ambitious postmodernist epic, the point is to engage the heart and mind of the reader and keep her turning the pages. And perhaps the most daunting part of creating a plot or a structure is knowing how and where to begin. In my next lecture, I'll talk about some strategies for getting started, using examples from William Faulkner, Mark Twain, and Marilynne Robinson.